From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The makeup of Utah's legislature hasn't changed in decades. It's controlled overwhelmingly by some fairly conservative Republicans. So observers were surprised and a little confused by some bills being proposed this year by Republicans that you can't really call anything other than progressive. A hate crimes bill, a bill that would legalize medical marijuana. One bill would have repealed the death penalty. And these bills got pretty close to getting passed. In the end, none of them made it. And so you have to wonder, did anything really change at Utah's Capitol Hill this year? Today in the program, we're live at the Hinckley Institute of Politics talking about what happened up there and what didn't and what almost did. A wrap-up of the 2016 legislative session today, after the news. This week in Video West, stories from the Tattoo Convention in Salt Lake City last weekend. Among the people you'll meet is Utah native Shanghai Kate, kind of a pioneer for women tattoo artists. In the early 70s, women weren't even supposed to get certain tattoos, and some parts of the body were off-limits to the ladies. They told Kate the business wasn't for her. And I guess you can imagine how that went over. Go see her and others at videowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Utah lawmakers ended their legislative session late last night, like they always do, working against the clock, trying to pass some bills last minute, having to ditch others. They passed a $14.7 billion budget that included $440 million for education. Along with that, they put money into a potential lawsuit to transfer millions of acres of federal land to state control. They gave more than $50 million to the state of California to shore up a coal port there. There's also money for water pipeline projects. But the bills that got most of the attention were the ones that seemed surprising for conservative lawmakers: medical marijuana, hate crimes, repealing the death penalty. None of those ended up passing, by the way, and the Salt Lake Tribune's headline summed things up pretty well. Out of character legislative session ends up with traditional results. Today in the program, we're live in the caucus room of the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah, and we're talking about this year's legislative session, what happened and what didn't. Joining us on the program is Greg Hughes. He, of course, is Speaker of Utah's House of Representatives. He is a Republican representing District 51 in Draper. And Mr. Speaker, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. Thanks for having me.
And Jim DeBacchus, Senator Jim DeBacchus, is with us, the Democrat from Salt Lake County's District 2 in the state Senate. He is Minority Caucus Manager and the former chair of the Utah Democratic Party. And Senator DeBacchus, welcome to you.
Great to be here.
Okay, so let me start with, I guess, sort of broadly for both of you. Governor Herbert has said this was, this is how he put it, one of the better sessions from his point of view. He gave you guys an A, maybe A minus. How are you thinking about the session? Speaker, you start.
You know, I seldom do I walk away from a session, Doug, upset or believing that we hadn't moved the needle and done better and left the state better than we found it. Last year's session was very different in terms of the tone and the heavy lifts that happened. This year, a little bit different. But again, I think that we did do some things that were important. They were transformative. Water, it's not a sexy issue. It's not one you put on campaign flyers in the fall. But water infrastructure, we're a fast-growing state, and a lot of that comes from the decisions planners made 50 years ago. And we've kind of lagged behind as policymakers now. And I think we made a major step forward in terms of our water infrastructure for the state that prepares us for the next 50 years. And that's a big deal. That's just one. But
yeah.
I felt good about the session. I thought it was a good session. We did good things.
Senator, what do you think?
I give it a D, and a low D.
Why?
Oh, you don't know why.
Are you serious about that, D?
Absolutely. D? Yeah. This was a terrible
is he ever serious,
session.
Doug, really? Come on.
All right, Hughes. Now, you got to understand, Greg has all the power in the world, and he runs it. Herbert is somewhere way in the background. His people tell him what happened. Greg is the one who makes everything happen. He has all the power. Me, I'm looking around the tables trying to grab a crumb or two, but Greg really decides what happens in the state. So from my point, looking up at the table, D.
And I started an F. So at a D, I've moved up, Doug, in the world of Dabacus. So.
I want to get to specifics of why you say D. Let me ask you, Mr. Speaker, you talked about last year compared to this year. It's interesting. The LDS Church issued this statement during the legislative session where they cautioned lawmakers against upsetting a balance that had been achieved last year. And they were particularly talking about the anti-discrimination law. But I'm wondering, you said you agreed with that statement. In the sense of going for some balance. And you've reportedly told your members this year that you wanted it all quiet on the Western Front.
Correct. Good reason.
Let's take a deep breath. So what do you mean by that? Are you thinking more broadly you weren't interested in that same kind of tumult that happened last year, or were you referring to something in
specific? No, just the opposite. I thought that it was probably the second most important – I mean, of the time I spent in the Speaker's office and in meetings trying to see things accomplished last year, Medicaid was the first – issue. And then second was the anti-discrimination religious liberty bill. What was unique about that bill and what we saw in after the session was it's become a model legislation for the country because it wasn't one or the other. We were able to find that commonality, treating people the way we want to be treated. There was a great spirit about the negotiations. It was tough, believe me, and there was probably tumult along the way. But where we landed and what we were able to do was historic, truly. What you see in a moment like that is you want to take full advantage of it. What we saw in terms of bills that were coming out probably began to look like the more traditional arguments and an advocacy, one camp, the other camp. Yep. And so I saw bills that were going to have very different end goals. And given the good work that we had done the year before, I felt like it was time to roll out that legislation, and show its fruit so that we could use that as a model in the future. And really, the bills we saw coming in the session did not have that same tone. So it was one of these, let's calm, let's get the legislation we passed last year and let's see its success, and then let's build on that. And I didn't see those opportunities as much this year. And so that's why that's the context behind the comment.
Senator, what did you make of that? There were on one hand, you had a bill that sort of wanted to that questioned the same-sex marriage ruling in the Supreme Court that had happened. Then on the other hand, you had, of course, Senator Urquhart's hate crimes legislation, sort of two point counterpoints there. What about that idea of balance? And so neither should happen because that it would upset a balance.
It was historic last year. It was a terrific moment that state came together, and after what happened subsequently in other states, people still talk about the Utah Compromise. It was a magic moment in the history of our state. This is just baloney. This, we did everything we're ever going to do for the homos, and we did it last session. Don't talk to us ever again. And then they came out with this crazy equity, which took LeVar Christensen's goofball laws, which said we don't have to follow the federal courts on gay marriage. That was one of them. Another one was, we're going to guard bathrooms and have people sign in where they're going in to make sure that transgendered people aren't doing stuff. That was one end of the balance. And on the other end was Senator Urquhart's bill, which said hate crimes need to be in Utah's law. Is it the same crime if you graffiti a smiley face on a synagogue as if you put a swastika on there? That's what hate crimes did for everybody. It says if you attack a whole group of people, you're doing more than vandalism. You're trying to terrorize a whole group of people. And it's not just gay people. It can be any group of people. It can be white people. It can be Mormons in Alabama, for example. There was no equivalency here, and it was outrageous that people said, well, we got crazy LeVar here, and then we've got Steve Urquhart and fair, reasonable hate crimes here. Therefore, the balance is to do nothing. That was a crock.
Speaker, you want to respond?
Yeah, let's look at this glass half full for a second. We have one of the most conservative states in the country. We saw great success last year. We saw some of the bills that I would have told you before the session began wouldn't even get serious attention in terms of the death penalty repeal, making it through a Senate committee, Senate floor, House, a law enforcement committee, and probably maybe only five votes away from a full repeal. there's a lot of movement going on. And
it's a bill that you support, we should mention, by the way.
That's right, yeah. I do. And I would regret if when we talk about this and we see the frustration from specific policies that are not passed, if we weren't taking inventory on kind of the shift in the mood and really the progress we're making as a state and its legislature on some of these issues that not long ago I think people would have thought were dead on arrival. So we're making progress. I think good things are happening. The conversations that happened during the session were productive.
All this presumes, Mr. Speaker, though, that then it will come back next year or potentially the year after that. And one of these days, this thing will get passed. These things will get passed. Do you think that's where you're headed?
Look, politics is the art of the possible. We do things in incremental steps. We'll see good progress made. We'll build on that. We'll learn from that. There'll be unintended consequences always from the bills that we pass. We take that in. And so this process and this legislative branch, it works the right way. It works the way people would want it to. You just can't get it all in one necessary – and I'm an impatient guy. Don't get me wrong. I like getting it done now. I'm on the clock. But, you know, you have to look at – this was my 14th session, and I can see – we're making great progress in the areas that Senator Backus points out, and I think we're doing it the way that Utah does these things in terms of finding overlap, making sure perfect isn't the enemy of good. We're making good progress. I'm proud of the legislature in terms of the policies that we've considered and the policies we've passed.
Medical marijuana, repealing the death penalty, hate crimes legislation, they all came out of the Senate. And I think you were joking when you said the Senate clean lost its mind. I know you were joking.
Crazy.
But were you
Senate.
Only sort of partly joking in the sense that – I mean the question is would these things have come from the House in the first
place?
Well,
when I got into the legislature, it was the House that was more maybe progressive, moderate in terms of what legislation it would consider. And it was the Senate that was very conservative and you wouldn't be able to get anything like this considered or passed. And that is where the policies were coming from, which was not what we've usually seen. So it was different, and I was teasing when I said that. But yeah, there was a lot of movement, a lot of change in terms of where those bills originate and how they move forward. But again, it's good to see, and I think that shows progress on the part of the legislative branch.
Senator Backus, do you think Senator Urquhart, who proposed both two of those quote-unquote progressive pieces of legislation. He won't be here next year. Senator Madsen proposed the medical marijuana. He won't be here either. Do you agree with the Speaker that these things could keep moving toward passage? Are you skeptical?
I'm pessimistic. I mean, I think these things have a moment. You take Senator Madsen out of it, who's going to pick up the marijuana bill? You know, is it going to be
you?
Pete Knudsen? I'm skeptical as to whether these things will ever happen. And I'm disappointed that the House, and I don't quite understand why it just didn't get thrown out on the floor and have a debate and see where it went.
I want to answer that, Doug, if we have time. But there's some other issues. I think some good things that were accomplished because these issues they take a lot of the political attention. But there's some other things that we've done. But let me just say to that. We have four physicians in the House that are House members on the Health and Human Services Committee also. If you have a bill that considers whether something ought to be medicinal or not, or that schedule should change, I don't know what committee you would send it to or what that committee would receive by way of a bill, if not this medicinal or the two medicinal marijuana bills that we had. I believe that if you were to just try to generalize the two bills, Senator Madsen's bill had THC in the cannabis and in the medicinal marijuana legislation, and its regulatory climate was not as strict. Senator Vicker's bill did not have THC in its medicinal marijuana language, and it was very regulated. What the committee did was that it took the THC and put it into Senator Vicker's bill, maintained a more regulated climate, and what we found in the aftermath of that committee hearing was that nobody liked that. Those that supported Senator Madsen's bill were frustrated that the regulatory climate was too strict. Those that were not supportive of marijuana being rescheduled or being considered medicinal didn't like the THC in that bill. And so you had a bill that came out of the House that I thought made great progress in trying to find that overlap. But what you ended up having is advocates of both bills truly fighting to kill that bill. And so – you know, if you're not making either side happy, but you're trying, those physicians, I ran into Representative Redd. He's a physician on the floor of the House at midnight 2 days before the session ended, and he was exhausted working on and trying to find progress and a good process for that bill. So I regretted, and it actually got me a little bit angry to hear some of the generalizations of my colleagues on that committee that it was a kill committee, that there wasn't serious consideration, because that was the case. They did take that very seriously.
Hey, we're running out of time. I want to get to a few of these issues that I'm guessing you'll think are important. You want to talk about Medicaid expansion. It seems like you're happy with the legislature's bill that extended coverage to some of the Utahns with this greatest need, some 16,000 Utahns. Advocates, of course, of full Medicaid expansion say you left out a lot of people.
It is. It's one of those don't let perfect be the enemy of good. There were a lot of mechanisms in terms of the financing and the ability for the state to balance its budget on percentages of future costs versus how we're able to appropriate dollars. We did this through a traditional Medicaid process. The most needy amongst us, one of the things we did in my office, we had a meeting of those that were working on justice reform, not incarcerating people that may be addicted to drugs because they committed crimes, but helping them get well. Ways of reducing recidivism. And that bill was passed last year, but we needed to continue the work. You have a homeless issue in downtown Salt Lake City that is not a Salt Lake City issue or a Salt Lake County issue, but a state issue. And the leadership of Representative Gibson from Utah County and our majority whip, we worked on the homelessness issue in terms of how we were going to improve that situation. We worked on the justice reform. And they overlapped with this very demographic we're talking about for Medicaid. So in a year where we had finite funds, we put everybody in this room and we said, where can we move the needle and do, instead of in a myopic way, here's your appropriations committee and what do you need? And almost doing it at the expense of
but
the
Mr.
other.
Mr. Speaker, I'm sure what you'll hear is that if you just take the federal money, you can cover all of that.
It's true. And it's one of those and we talked about this last year. It's one of those make no payments for 2 years. As interest accrues or costs or payments will ultimately result, but enjoy it now. And really, that's not the way our legislature has done it. And that process of 10% of a future number was something that we just couldn't get our heads around. And we do believe that this bill does help the most needy amongst us and also hits on those critical issues of homelessness and justice reform.
Senator, how are you thinking about the expansion?
First, Speaker Hughes led the way on the homeless. That he gets an A. The House gets an A. Representative Gibson
there
gets an A.
There goes my reelect, by the way. That just that right there. That
I'm prepared to endorse Speaker.
You know, the fix is in right there. I hope you know.
No, the whole state recognized that this isn't just a Salt Lake City and a Salt Lake County. There's money and programs and a lot. And I think that was the highlight of the whole session. And I think it was a speaker who led the way, and for that there will be a whole generation of Utahns that'll be grateful, and a lot less people will be cold and hungry and drug addicted, and it is because of your leadership. You screwed up everything else, Hughes, but
thank you
on that. I really would give you a big hug, but I don't want rumors to start. And by the way. Every time,
like
this is the radio, right? Every time we go speak somewhere, they look at him and look at these tailored suits. He's always fashionable, the perfect haircut. I'm kind of frumpy and the tail's out. They say, which one is gay? So getting back to Medicaid expansion.
Is that a compliment? I'm so confused right now. I don't know what's happening in here.
Okay, so
what's going on?
Here's what happened. Arizona took full Medicaid expansion. Arizona. They're crazier than we are. Nevada took it. New Mexico took it. Colorado took it. Montana took it. The states are taking it. It was a check that Utahns had paid in for $473 million over the last 2 years to provide health care for our poorest of the poor families. And the Republicans are going, you know, we got to teach that federal government a lesson. And we have to pay 10%. How will we ever come up with 10%? Mitt Romney and Bain Capital. If you were going to give them a check for $450 or $500 million, but you had to pay $50 million back, they'd figure out a way to get it. This is ideology at its worst. They took that check. You know, they went out to the mailbox. There was their tax return $450 or $60 million. I'll get you the exact number because they were still fighting about it. They went out to the mailbox. The tax return was there. They looked at it, ripped up the check, threw it in the air, and pointed to Washington and said, "That'll teach them." A lot of Utahns suffered and will suffer and will die because the legislature is so tuned into the Tea Party and placating them that we really screwed it up. 16,000 instead of 105,000. This was a terrible, terrible decision.
So Mr. Speaker, I want to move on, but do you want to take a quick second?
Yes, please. Let me just say that the states that have decided to get into this will never know they'll never know the consequence until they have to pay their bill, which isn't until 2020. So you have some politicians out there that saw the immediate benefit without regard to how their state was going to pay their end of the bill. I would go analogy to analogy. I got a big brother. The federal government's my big brother, right, Jim? It's maxed all its credit cards. It's in debt. It's owned everything it has on credit. And it's telling its little brother, who has a rainy day, has a savings account, balances all of its budget, does everything, albeit smaller. Hey, you're not doing this the right way. You got to borrow more. You got to spend more. You got to spend more. How do we pay for it? You don't need to know about that now till 2020. That is not the way the state of Utah has balanced its budget. That's not the way we've made our decisions. And so it sounds great today, and probably for many, the immediate benefit or even political accolades that you'd receive for doing it now without knowing how you're going to be able to budget that in the year 2020, it's not responsible. And we owe it to our citizens in this state to know that when we say we're going to do it, it's going to go beyond the year 2020, that you can pro forma that out.
We're essentially out of time, but I wanted to get to another, at least one more. Mr. Speaker, you said in your opening day address that you had a goal of eliminating so-called red air days in Utah by improving air quality monitoring and research. How do you think you did this year?
We can always do better, Doug. We had a lot of inversion days during the session this year. Last year, it was blue skies. I think our legislation must have been brilliant because we just didn't have a bad day last year. This year, we did. We put $6 million into a new Department of Environmental Quality building that is dedicated to working on, and the air quality, Division of Air Quality is in there. The DEQ building, we were told by the governor's office, was a major component. We put more money into the monitoring equipment. Our monitoring equipment, we don't have as much. We need to do better there. And we put more money into the awareness, where people don't know what they don't know, and where we can help as a state let people know and the public know there are ways and choices we can make that can contribute to cleaner air. We did that. There's other legislation out there. Again, when you're balancing your budget, it's important to know that you don't throw away all the dumb ideas and only fund the good ones. Sometimes you have to prioritize, and you know that the things you're unable to fund are important and impactful.
The modern air quality testing equipment, you weren't able to fund that this year. And I have to say, a lot of clean air activists are particularly upset over the amount of money you're spending to send coal to, or at least clean up a coal port in California rather than invest in equipment to improve air here in Utah. Do you want to respond to those concerns?
Well, I'll tell you that the port will do two things. I think it keeps Utah's economy strong. The coal that it would be exported is clean coal. In the areas of the world that coal would go, it would reduce its emissions if they had better access to, and the state of Utah had better access to those parts of the world. Was projected, and we heard on the floor debate, up to 50% of the air quality could be improved through clean coal versus the coal that those parts of the world are using right now that's particularly dirty. I don't think that it's not myopic. It's not one or the other in terms of coal being a contributor to bad air. There is a great not only economy but quality to the natural resources we have in this state and our ability to encourage trade, but also have that clean coal be more readily available. I think it's a good thing. I really do.
Senator DeBacchus, what do you say to that?
Well, the Republicans find that giving money to fossil fuel polluters is somehow the best way to clean air. The most outrageous contribution to Rocky Mountain Power you can imagine, when a fiasco in getting it passed, study that if you want to see how corporate influence has a dramatic effect on the legislature. $53 million of public money going to build a port in Oakland so we can ship coal there that probably isn't going to be used. And so we're, taxpayers, at least money that should be used by the local impacted communities that are so desperately being hurt now, is going off to build a port. We've got $7 million a year that we've given to the big oil companies in foregoing severance tax. We came this close to $14 million a year to our refineries out here to incentivize them to do what they're doing in other states, which is to get to Tier 3. What happened is they looked at it and said, you know what, this isn't enough incentive. We're pulling that back. But that was going to be $280 million a year over 20 years out of our education fund directly to those polluting refineries in North Salt Lake. We averted that one, but the legislature was right there ready to give them the money. We need to learn how to really clean up the air and how not to funnel all this money off to the big corporations.
Doug, just real quickly, the dollars for that port are not from new revenue or budget dollars that we were considering to spend one way or the other. Those are funds that are generated internally already, just giving the permissive language to make sure that those funds that are generated from natural resources and other things could be used towards that effort. But we didn't use it at the expense of other budget considerations.
Okay. We're out of time, gentlemen. Thank you very much. Representative Greg Hughes is the Republican Speaker of the Utah House. Senator Jim DeBacchus, the Democratic Minority Caucus Manager. Thanks again for being here.
We're not finished talking.
Jim exhausts me.
I know you do. Take it out in the hall.
I'm more tired after this than I was before.
We'll continue the conversation when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Utah lawmakers wrapped up another legislative session right around the stroke of midnight last night. Today in the program, we are live in the caucus room at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah, talking about what happened up there, what they did, what they didn't, what they came close to doing. Brian Grimmett is with us, online editor and reporter for KUER News. Brian, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Jennifer Dobner, a justice and safety reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. She covers some of the things that are going on up at Utah's Capitol Hill. Jennifer, welcome back to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Robert Gerke back with us, a government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Welcome to you.
Happy to be here. They're an easy act to follow, aren't they?
I know. The governor gives them an A-, says it was a good time. It didn't seem to be a lot of tension between the two branches like there sometimes is, at least seemed that way anyway. Broad assessments, first of all, of what you think happened broadly at the legislature this year. Robert, you start.
Well, I think, you know, everybody I talked to in the hallways all session long was commenting on how it seemed to be such a sort of genteel kind of mellow session, that there wasn't a lot of the rough and tumble fighting that we've seen in the past over contentious issues. Obviously, you hit on a few that were sort of got a lot of attention, the medical marijuana and the hate crimes legislation and the death penalty repeal. Those were probably the three biggest or at least highest profile. But by and large, we had a session that moved at a deliberate pace and without a lot of fireworks, frankly.
Why? I mean, I asked the speaker whether it had to do with I'm not sure if it was directly impacted by the LDS Church saying, "Hey, let's find some balance." Wondered was he trying to change the dynamic in some way?
No.
Trying to find some kind of balance?
You know, I feel like there wasn't a great deal of a sense of urgency on behalf of leadership to get a lot of things done. So if things didn't pass, they didn't pass, you know, and so they just kind of moved along with some deliberacy. And I think also, you know, in an election year, you kind of steer away from some of the tougher issues. Last year they raised taxes. This year they weren't going to do that because they have to go back to the voters this year and say, hey, you know, send me back. So I think election year politics had something to do with it as well.
What do you guys think?
Well, I think even from the beginning of the session, talking to some of the leadership, as Robert was saying, is they just weren't, there wasn't that urgency. They even from day one, they were just kind of like, well, if we get, we'll get to the important bills or the bills we think are important and all the rest are okay. I mean, I think it was interesting that at the beginning of the session, they had more proposed legislation than really ever before. And yet they ultimately passed fewer bills this year than they had in the past two. So there really wasn't that drive. And I think it did have to do some with election year politics and some with they just didn't really think they needed to address some of these bigger issues after how dramatic last year was.
Huh. Jennifer?
Well, I don't have as broad a perspective as these guys because I was really focused on two things, LGBT legislation and the death penalty. And I would argue that the church's statement about balance really produced the most sort of tension and angst. Senator Urquhart, who is himself a Mormon, you know, was unequivocal in saying that the church had essentially killed his hate crimes bill and that had been really personally devastating to him because he had considered the church, you know, a light in his life. And he said that light has gone out. So that that was a very different kind of response to the kind of what's the right word? Help me, Robert. The kind of influence that the church usually wields up there. You don't usually hear people, you know, calling them out like that. So that was
certainly
a very
not
different
Republican,
moment.
Certainly not Mormon Republicans.
Yes,
and you heard this from Senator Mattson too, pushing
correct.
Back on the church's influence in his medical marijuana legislation.
Right, and you know, Senator Mattson wasn't questioning whether the church, as a member of society, should be able to weigh in on this. He was upset about the way in which they did it. I mean, these sort of broad edicts about opposing specific legislation, and he felt like they didn't have the discussion, the dialogue, and explain their concerns to him before they came out with this. They just came out and squashed it. So the church, if you look at their track record this session, I mean, they were involved in the medical marijuana bill, and they opposed the THC legalization. They opposed hate crimes. They were involved in liquor reform more behind the scenes, but there wasn't much done on that regard. So once again, I think they showed that they exerted a tremendous amount of influence in the Utah legislature.
So I would just say that I asked the church specifically about whether or not they opposed the language of the hate crimes bill, because in 2003, so we had a six-year window there from 2000 to about 2005, 2006, where this very same language, the sexual orientation language in the protected classes of hate crimes legislation, they did not oppose that language then. So I asked them specifically this year, has your position on that language changed? If you're not going to say anything more specific than, you know, don't pass anything that upsets the balance, just tell me, do you oppose the language? They wouldn't answer the question.
Yeah.
And what I hear privately is that they didn't really oppose the bill. They just weren't really willing to go there this year.
I wonder, what did you make of these three pieces of legislation that we're probably spending too much time talking about? But is this just circumstance? Is this just a coincidence? Or is there some kind of libertarian / progressive strain going on in the legislature that seems to kind of be emerging?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think it's all of those things. I think you had in both Senator Mattson and Senator Urquhart two guys who had sort of accrued a considerable amount of political capital and had their own sort of ideological frames of reference. And you know, they were both leaving the body, and you can't take the political capital with you unless you're going to run for another office, which I don't think either of them are. And so they decided they were going to spend it on something they believed in, and maybe it isn't popular, maybe it's not going to get them reelected, but, you know, they don't care. So they pushed those issues hard, and they found a body that was maybe more receptive than I think even, the speaker told me last night. He didn't think death penalty was going to get any traction. A lot of people didn't expect medical marijuana to make it as far as it did. So that was part of it. You also have, especially in the House, I think this dynamic emerging where you have sort of you have different strains of Republicanism in the state since you've got sort of the Rand Paul libertarian conservatives, you have the Chamber of Commerce conservatives, you have your rural conservatives, and there's overlap between the two certainly, but you know, the libertarian conservatives, especially in the last few years, have been an emerging power in the House. A lot of the younger members, sort of represent that view. So I think there is overlap, and I think it was a sort of a you know, these things kind of built on each other to make this environment possible for these bills to kind of go as far as they did.
I put the same question to Brian off air earlier, you know, and he had the same answer, yes, to all of the above.
Well, and I think that is kind of the interesting thing about it is that while I do think it was the personalities of Urquhart and Mattson pushing these bills they really care about, it is starting to be more receptive, and it's interesting to see how the libertarian strain of the Republican Party is in some ways almost a progressive strain in there, and there's the overlap. I mean, some of these key bills, the lobbyist groups working for them were joining hands with the ACLU, which is typically seen as the anti-Republican type of organization, but they were working together to get some of these things passed.
I have a sort of a different maybe theory, and having been a religion reporter for a long time, I do think that there may be, and I don't know this for a fact, we do see a parallel in what's happening in Mormonism, that there is a whole strain of more moderate, more centrist, sort of second wave Mormons who don't fall in line sometimes. And I don't know if Mattson and Urquhart fall into that category, but certainly there's an evolution going on in the church, and it would follow that in some segment of Utah's Mormon population, that I mean, it's happening there. So yeah. Maybe there's a spillover. I don't know, but that's how my brain works.
The speaker seemed to suggest that, oh, so we've now made progress in all of these things, and just, you know, wait a couple years, we'll get there. But you don't have Urquhart anymore. You won't anyway, and you won't have Senator Mattson. So do any of those pieces of legislation, capital punishment, hate crimes, medical marijuana, do they have much of a future on Utah's Capitol Hill?
Well, talking to the advocates who are working on hate crimes and the death penalty, they absolutely think so, because as my understanding is, they were only 5 votes short of passing the death penalty bill. Well, to get there, you have to have an awful lot of Republicans on your side. The Democrats don't have the numbers or the political clout to get you there. So I don't know if it goes away. It might take another, you know, 5, 10, I don't know how many years it would take, but I don't think we won't hear about it. But you probably have a different point of view.
No, I think I think on hate crimes in particular, you'll see that one back, because that had broad support among prosecutors and the sort of the law enforcement community and the senators who were who are active in those issues. And there's already been people stepping forward and saying, "Yeah, I'm going to run this next year." Death penalty, I think, is going to be a little bit trickier because, yeah, they that bill sort of had a charmed life in some ways, getting through the Senate the way it did. I think it's going to have some problems next year. I suspect somebody will run it, but I'm not sure who it's going to be. And medical marijuana will be back. I mean, because you saw Senator Vickers this session sponsoring legislation on it. There have been enough people engaged on that issue, particularly over in the House, that I think you'll see it. Now, getting that critical mass of the 38 votes in the House to get any of those issues through is going to be another question. And part of that probably depends on the dynamics of this next election. Are we going to see the same people sent back? Are we going to see a more moderate body? Which way is it going to go? And so I think that kind of remains to be seen.
Just quickly, I think on medical marijuana as well, even if they don't do anything about it, there's always the prospect of the ballot initiative. And I think there are people that believe that there's support for a ballot initiative. I don't know how far that would go, but even if they don't have the time this year to do it, they're serious about it.
And they have money.
Yeah, and they have money.
What happened with water? Let's shift gears. The House and the Senate both gave their approval to this bill that would create this special water infrastructure fund. And the speaker seemed pretty proud of those things. Put that in perspective for us. What happens with water? What happened up there?
Well, this is, coming into the session, I kind of, because I'm Nostradamus now, I predicted that this was going to be a big issue, because you have this effort by Senator Adams to earmark money for these water projects, but there's a lot of resistance, particularly to the Lake Powell pipeline. There's questions about how much it's going to cost the people, the water users down there over the long term, whether there is a economically viable plan to repay this. But so what they've done though is created this account. They came up with a list from all the water conservancy districts of I think it was $300 billion in infrastructure needs. Now there are questions about whether those numbers were inflated, you know, and regardless, the case was made to the legislators that we needed to start putting money aside to start chipping away at this. He took the money, interestingly, out of transportation, which is another one. They made the same argument. We have these transportation needs, and we're going to start funding them over the course of a period of years. So that's where they're going with this. It's going to, you know, it's going to set aside a tremendous amount of money for these big projects, and the Bear River project is going to be a big one that also, you know, is upsetting some people. But even the governor is reluctant. He remains reluctant, frankly, on Lake Powell. He wants to see more data on conservation efforts. He wants to see more data on the long-term repayment and the need and the fact that the water is actually there. So there are still some, I guess, obstacles or some boxes that need to be checked before we start seeing this. But yeah, it's going to be a significant, as you mentioned, millions and millions of dollars worth of investment in these water projects over the next decades.
It's Robert Gerke, government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Brian Grimmett, online editor and reporter for KUER News. Jennifer Dobner, justice and safety reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. They're with us here in the caucus room at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah. We're talking about the 2016 legislative session, and we need to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are live at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah. We're talking about the 2016 legislative session with KUER reporter Brian Grimmett. We also have Salt Lake Tribune reporters Jennifer Dobner and Robert Gerke. So I wanted to, Jennifer, you mentioned you had been paying attention to some of the LGBT bills up on the Hill this year. What can you say about what was going on? I mean, the hate crimes bill we talked a little bit about. There was an effort, as Senator DeBacchus talked about, to sort of push back on the Supreme Court same-sex ruling. What happened up there in that regard?
Well, I would say this is probably the the opposite end of the church's statement spectrum that maybe helped protect the LGBT community. LeVar Christensen, a Republican from Draper in the House, had a sovereign marriage authority bill, I think it was called, which would have basically said that Utah could ignore the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the Obergefell case. And if we had to give gay people marriage licenses, but we didn't have to give them anything else, no other marriage-related benefits, particularly in the areas of foster care and adoption, which would mean if you were a gay person who wanted children, that Utah could bar you from that, which they used to do before, marriage was legal. That bill came out and went nowhere. Angela Romero, a Democrat out of Salt Lake City, also in the House, she was trying to make a technical change in state law that the Division of Child and Family Services had actually asked for to, change the words man and woman in adoption and foster care law to the generic terms, non-gender specific terms, spouse, parents, et cetera. That died on the whole Obergefell argument in the same committee. So Troy Williams from the Equality Utah says he thinks, some Republicans are still grieving the loss of marriage. And so what they're doing is sort of looking for ways to build barriers and hem the gay community in. I don't know how long that will go on. Maybe a long time, maybe not. But I think the gay community came out, kind of maybe even. They didn't make any significant gains, but they also were protected from significant losses.
I wanted to ask about education. $14.7 billion in the budget. I think it was something like $440 million for public schools and higher education. And it was, this surprised me, $18 million more than the governor had actually asked for.
Right. Just to clarify that, that's $440 million in new money.
Right.
Overall, I think it's about $6 billion now goes to public and higher education. Yeah, the legislature had a little bit of an advantage because they were working with a little bit more education money than the governor had. But, yeah, they pushed a significant amount of money into public education, and a part of that is because under Utah's constitution, and here's the exciting part, income taxes are earmarked for education. So that money was supposed to go there anyway. But this is sort of a continuing trend that we've seen over the last several years as the economy's recovered, the state's starting to put more and more money into public education. I think we're up to, $1.6 billion of new money into education over the last 4 years. There were some areas they didn't put as much into the per pupil spending, sort of this lump sum that districts get for students that they can decide for themselves, because the legislature tends to like to tell districts where they'd like this money spent. So, for example, they put $15 million into a technology initiative so they can get, more technology in classrooms and that sort of thing. So, but I think, at the end of the day, education, there was a decent increase for public education. Charters, schools got some equalization funding. There was this technology money that we talked about. And then there were some changes in policy on things like the testing, the way they're going to score students' testing when they look at teachers. So, as is always the case, I believe there was something like 150 education bills sponsored this year, or bills dealing with education. It was a remarkable number of bills that were introduced on education. So it's always a big topic up there.
Well, one of the interesting things they also did about education that wasn't so much budget related was they finally came to a decision on what to do with state school board elections. There's some background information there that a judge has said the current process isn't constitutional, basically, or isn't legal. But there was this big debate: do we do nonpartisan or partisan? And for years they were deadlocked, and somehow the House basically gave in. And so starting not this year, but starting in 2018. They'll have partisan school board elections, which I think once we get to that point will be actually rather interesting.
Well, I wondered about that, actually. Why would that matter in a state that's so overwhelmingly Republican?
Well, I think the education establishment liked the nonpartisan elections because voters go into the booth and they make the decision sometimes just based on the board member's name, I guess, but also you can look at the ideas and it also allows the sort of the education establishment to kind of try to shape that a little bit more. Now in a state like this where overwhelmingly Republican, you go into the booth, you don't know anything about the candidates, your default position becomes vote Republican. And so I think the concern among the teachers' unions and the education establishment is that you're going to end up seeing more ideological divides on the school board rather than, policy, focus on policy that they would like to see in that role.
I think they almost see it as an extension of what the legislature does every year anyways, that when you've got the legislature that is partisan, they try to push these partisan agendas. And not that they've been devoid of that on the state school board, but this would maybe make it even more of an issue, more of those ideological issues being pushed upon the policy.
Well, lawmakers don't appear to be giving up on the lawsuit to transfer federal lands to the state. They provided, $4.5 million to this lawsuit. Kanab Republican Mike Noel, this is his thing. This is his baby. He says, I think we have all the tools in place now. Is he right?
Yeah. I mean, he is. They've got a law firm that's working on putting together a complaint that the Attorney General can file. The Commission on the Stewardship of Public Lands has sort of green-lighted this to the extent they can. The decision, the ultimate decision, now rests with the governor and the Attorney General on whether or not to pursue this. So then they've got the $4.5 million, which is the overall the lawsuit's projected to cost about $14 million to see it all the way through. But this is sort of the first installment. They've set up this account where if anybody wants to give money to help fund this lawsuit, you can write your check to the state and they'll put it into this account and put it toward that. And so, and we also saw, and this was sort of a little bit below the surface, but a beefing up of the number of attorneys dealing with public lands issues in the Attorney General's office. So they're putting the pieces in place to do this should the Attorney General decide he wants to pull the trigger on it. He hasn't done that yet, and so they're kind of waiting and see. The governor is talking about this public lands initiative that Congressman Chaffetz, Congressman Bishop, Senator Lee are pushing, and he wants to see that play, you know, play itself out, I think, before he makes any decisions on, well, let's go to court and see how this goes. One of the interesting sort of complicating factors in this whole calculus, I guess, is that the state strategy kind of hinged a little bit on a 5-4 Supreme Court. Now with Justice Scalia dying, and we don't know who's going to replace who's going to be the replacement, if it's going to come this year, if it's going to come after the election, who's going to win the election, it kind of puts all of that up in a little bit of uncertainty.
I wanted to ask about air quality. If you want to say anything about that, it doesn't appear. Speaker Hughes seemed to think he got a lot done. He said made some promises to deal with that, but I think you're getting some sense from certainly clean air activists that not much, if anything, really happened that was that significant. What do you think?
It's hard to say. I mean, one of the biggest things they did isn't necessarily that sexy, but is giving tax credits to Tier 3 to allow the refineries to give tax credits to be able to make the changes to go to what's called Tier 3 fuels. It's supposed to be a lot cleaner burning, and I think by 2025 or something like that, the all new cars will be able to take benefit of those. I think 80% emission reduction, is that about?
I think it's 30%, but actually that bill in the very last hour of the session ended up dying because they didn't get it funded. There was some confusion, I guess, with getting it funded, and so it ended up dying.
So they didn't do that. Then
they didn't do that. And President Niederhauser and Majority Leader Ralph Okerlund both said that was the one thing that the legislature could do that would make more of an impact on cleaning up Utah's air than anything else, and it fell short. It is kind of interesting that one of the highlights on air quality is building a building, and it's kind of, you know, I don't know if that necessarily cleans up the air all that much. I mean, I know and I understand that you have DEQ that's going to be housed there, but there the air monitoring stations you mentioned, they did fund air monitoring stations that EPA is requiring them to build in Utah County and in some of the outlying areas, but the ones in Salt Lake County, they were looking for money for those because they're falling apart, and they didn't fund that. There was an incentive program to change out to old polluting equipment that didn't get funded. Yeah. There was a solar bill that Francis Gibson sponsored, basically if you have solar panels on your roof, you can enter into these agreements to sell power back to the power company. That bill passed, and environmentalists and clean air groups are pleased with that. Representative Patrice Arendt, who is one of the sort of leaders on this issue, I talked to her last night, and she said, you know, in years past, she's felt pretty good about what they've done. You know, they've taken incremental steps. She said this year, it's kind of a mixed bag. She's coming away feeling a little bit, a little bit unimpressed.
It's Robert Gerke. He and Jennifer Doebner are with the Salt Lake Tribune. Brian Grimmett is online editor and reporter for KUER News. Guys, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks today to the Hinckley Institute of Politics for hosting us. Engineering support from Adrian Moranville, Brian Albers, KUER's engineer Lewis Downey, with help from Tim Slover back in the studio. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard, Andy Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.